Welcome to A Life in Biography. This episode is all me. I want to talk about how close is too close in terms of a biographer working on a biographical subject. This topic occurred to me, or was refreshed, I should say, when I saw a film recently called May December, starring Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman. I'm especially interested in the character that Natalie Portman plays, an actress, Elizabeth Berry, because as I watched Portman and her character, Elizabeth Berry, I was thinking a lot about my own experience as a biographer, particularly my work for a biography called titled To Be a Woman, The Life of Jill Craigie. While I was researching that book, I didn't realize I was also researching another biography, that is the biography of Jill Craigie's husband, Michael Foote. I'll explain more about that in a moment. Just a brief summation of the film. I'm leaving out a lot. I'm not interested that much in the other characters in the film or other ways of looking at the film. This is very much a film which responds to my experience as a biographer. So here's the summary. In 2015, actress Elizabeth Berry arrives in Savannah, Georgia, to research her upcoming role in an independent film. Elizabeth will be playing Gracie Atherton Yu, who in 1992, at the age of 36, was caught having sex with 13-year-old Korean-American Joe Yu, a schoolmate of her son Georgie, at the pet store where they both worked. Hence the May-December title of the film. This is based on a real life story. I'm not so much interested in that. There are a lot of news stories about this movie and to what extent it actually conforms to the real life story of a teacher who fell in love with her young pupil. What interests me is Natalie Portman's portrayal of Elizabeth Berry, this actress who's going to impersonate a real-life person. And what it reminds me of is my experience with Michael Foote and Jill Craigie. I first met Michael Foote and Jill Craigie when I was doing my biography of Rebecca West, because both of them had been friends of Rebecca West, particularly Jill, who was a great champion of Rebecca West and who was instrumental in getting some of Rebecca West's work back into print. So I met Jill Craigie, liked her very much, very, very attractive person and very forthcoming. And Michael is just, he died in 2010, was ebullient. The best way I would describe him, especially in terms of his relationship with me, is avuncular. He was old enough to be my father. He was 87 when I started working on Jill Craigie's life. I was somewhat younger when I was doing Rebecca West. And I was 52 when I began working on the biography of Jill Craigie in the year 2000. So a little bit of the backstory. In late 1999, around Christmas, I was reading the New York Times, and I came across an obituary for Jill Craigie, which talked about her early work as a documentary filmmaker in Britain, her journalism, her feminism, I was very attracted to the obituary and what it said about her. Some of it I knew, of course, from meeting her and in a sense, doing some background work on the figures in Rebecca West's life. But there was a lot I didn't know and a lot that intrigued me. And this is not the first time I've done this. I just had a gut feeling that I should write Jill's biography. So what I did was I wrote to Michael Foote. And he had been very cooperative when I was writing my Rebecca West biography. And he wrote a biography of H.G. Wells. And there's a long footnote in the H.G. Wells biography which praises my biography of Rebecca West. Anyway, I wrote to Michael Foote, essentially, although I had only interviewed him once, he was so genial. He was such a friendly person. I felt that we were instantaneous friends. So I wrote to him, "Dear Michael," like I was writing to a friend. And I wrote to him just a few months after his wife, Jill, died, and said to him essentially in the letter, "This may be premature, it may be too early, but if you ever consider having someone writing a biography of your wife, please let me know, because I would like to do it or be considered for it." I did know how he would react to this. I didn't know. Subsequently, and certainly in retrospect, I realized he was what he told me when he phoned me. He didn't answer my letter. He called me. I must have left my phone number on the letter. He called me. He was incredibly enthused, really happy that I wanted to do his wife's biography. I am sure he was used to people asking if they could do his biography. After all, he was a former Labour Party leader, ran against Margaret Thatcher. He was a former editor of the London Evening Standard. He wasn't just a politician. He was a cultural figure in England. He had written a book on Byron. He had written about Jonathan Swift. He had friends in the theatrical movie community, of course, in politics. In all walks of life, he was just a considerable figure in England. If you don't know that, you know it now. He called me and he says, "Oh, you're the one. You're the one to do it. You're the one to do Jill's biography." And so in March 2000, I went to see him in Hampstead at his house. He was very welcoming. He was still grieving. He looked like a ghost to me, very frail, very white, very shaken by his wife, who had been such a staunch supporter of him. I realized later another reason why he was so enthused is he thought of Rebecca West as a great figure, as I do, of course. And so that the biographer of Rebecca West would want to do a biography of Jill Craigie, who was certainly a public figure, but nowhere, on, as far as he was concerned, on the scale in terms of, you know, as a writer, as Rebecca West. He worried, actually, I realized when I got into my biography of her, researching her, that I might feel that she was too small as a subject. That's an interesting topic in biography, too. Is someone too small for a biography? I'll give you my answer. Nobody is too small for a biography if you want to write that person's biography. I often read in book reviews, "Oh, is so-and-so worthy of biography?" Of course they are, if you have a story to tell about that person, whether the person's famous or not. The other issue, of course, is getting a publisher. That's a different story. But in terms of biography, every person has an intrinsic value. And if you see that intrinsic value, it doesn't matter how many books or movies or achievements that person has had. I've used this example before. When I lived in Detroit, in an apartment building down the hall, there was a fellow named Cyril Forbes, who was a retired. He had been essentially a bureaucrat. He was in the city of Detroit's administration. And not high up, just I can't remember what Cyril did. I found Cyril an absolutely fascinating human being. We would spend hours talking. My wife, Lisa, found him. I think about Cyril all the time. We would invite Cyril for dinner. He would tell us stories about his wife who had died. I could have written Cyril's biography, but I had other other commitments. I couldn't do it. He told me wonderful stories about Detroit, going decades and decades back into the city's history. Well, that's a digression, but it's to say why I was interested in Jill Craigie. My first thought was not, can I get a publisher? My first thought was not, is she worthy of a biography? No, it was, I had this conviction that I was the person to write about Jill Craigie, and I think that's what Michael Foote responded to. Okay, so unlike many of my other projects as a biographer where I've faced hostility, skepticism, rejection, which I've talked about on other podcasts and in my book, Confessions of a Serial Biographer, it was like a love match with Michael Foote. And of course, that's can be a biographer's problem too. This is where we get into this topic, getting too close to your subject. So Michael invites me into his home in March 2000. And I work on this book off and on for 3 years. One of the first things he said to me is, you must stay with me when you come to London. All Jill's papers are in the house. She had her own study. And you have carte blanche. You can look at everything. There's nothing is off limits. It's your book, he said. Michael, I should say also, was a biographer himself. So he understood the tensions, conflicts, the various problems biographers can have. He was giving me complete license to look anywhere in the house. And believe me, I looked everywhere in the house, in his bedroom, in drawers, because he and Jill often just stuff things in drawers, letters, you know, from all kinds of famous people. The actress Peggy Ashcroft, but the Prime Minister Tony Blair, I might come across in opening a drawer or picking out a book in Michael's bookshelves. I slept in his library, huge library. And I would take a book down the shelf and there would be a letter from some prominent personality. So I became Michael's guest. Of course, I interviewed Michael about his wife, Jill Craigie. I interviewed Jill's daughter, Julie, who is Michael Foote's stepdaughter. That is, it was Jill's daughter by a different marriage before Michael. And Michael introduced me to many of his friends. In fact, that was often a problem because Michael would say, oh, let's talk to so-and-so. Neil Kinnock, for example. Also a Labour Party leader at one time. And he would invite people like that over to the house to talk to me, which was great in one hand. You know, I had this entree to this whole world of politics and literature and so on. Salman Rushdie's wife, for example, came over and I interviewed her because he knew Jill and Michael. In fact, appeared in a documentary that Jill did called 2 Hours from London about the war in the Balkans. But the problem was, Michael was always there. And although I'm not a shy person, and there were no questions that would have embarrassed me, and he didn't look like he would be embarrassed, nevertheless, obviously it changes the emotional tone of interviews if your subject's husband, Michael Foote, Jill Craigie's husband, Michael Foote, is there in the room with you while you're interviewing people. So I did, nevertheless, I did learn a lot of things, but of course I began to cultivate contacts independently and got out of the house to interview writers, all sorts of figures who knew Jill Craigie and knew Michael Foote and had opinions about their marriage, which I'm sure they would not have expressed in Michael Foote's house. In many ways, it was a great, happy marriage. And in many ways, it was kind of like the marriage between the Carlyles, Jane and Thomas Carlyle, which I say in my biography of Jill Craigie and also in my follow-up biography, A Private Life of Michael Foote. So I haven't forgotten about this film, May December, and the actress Elizabeth Berry, because what is Elizabeth Berry doing? She's following her subject, the woman that she's going to play in the film, around. She's following Gracie, played by Julianne Moore, around imitating her gestures, meeting her friends, being introduced at a party. Later in the film, having a sexual encounter with Gracie's young husband. I'll get back to that later. What happens to the actress, like a biographer, when you're, in a sense, included as part of the family? What people begin to think, whether they're conscious of this or not, is they're beginning to manipulate you. Because you're no longer just the biographer. In this case, I'm Michael Foote's friend. And he's praising me to the skies in front of people. What are people going to think? Well, they're going to think this is an authorized biography, first of all. And they're very doubtful that I'm going to say anything critical about Michael Foote or probably Jill Craigie, or about their marriage, certainly. And people did have critical things to say about the marriage. So many people form this impression. Almost none of them, especially the political types, and he had this, what I call this cordon sanitaire of women around him who protected him. Some of them had been former secretaries of him, who idolized him as an icon of the Labour Party. And we're going to do everything possible to protect his reputation. Well, and this is really amazing. On my first trip to England, I had a dinner in a pub with Michael Foote's stepdaughter, Julie. And Julie had very mixed feelings about Michael Foote. She thought that her mother was too supine, catered too much to Michael. That whole story is in my biography of Jill Craigie, and it's also in A Private Life of Michael Foote. I won't go on to that in detail. And I started spending a lot of time with Julie. And people started to get nervous, that is, people around Michael. They didn't tell me they were nervous, but I could tell from casual comments, particularly from Jenny Stringer, who was one of these women who was what I would call one of Michael's minders. She would make snide comments, and she even said, as things went on, after a few trips that I took, Jenny, you know, said, you know, Julie's a big liar. And so you got to be careful to take, you know, as truth what she tells you. And Jenny wasn't the only person to say this. But what I was struck by, Julie, is her candor and her introducing me to some of her friends who are candid about Julie. And most of what Julie had to tell me, I found later corroborated in her mother's letters. So Julie became God's gift to a biographer, because she was one of the most indiscreet people in the world. And I don't say this pejoratively. As I say, she was God's gift to a biographer. She completely penetrated that cordon sanitaire about around Michael and his marriage. And although some of that story is told in To Be a Woman, The Life of Jill Craigie, even more of that story is in A Private Life of Michael Foote, because what I can do in A Private Life of Michael Foote is include myself, to include me as a character in it. It would have been inappropriate in To Be a Woman, The Life of Jill Craigie. People wanted to read about Jill Craigie. But the whole point of A Private Life of Michael Foote was about myself as a biographer, what I got to know about Michael, and my interactions with Michael as well. So what happens? One of the things that happens in the course of doing this biography of Jill is I start traveling with Michael. I go with him to Dubrovnik, which was one of his favorite vacation spots. I accompany him to Plymouth, England, where he grew up, and I meet people who knew him both before politics and after politics. He was a member of Parliament from Plymouth for many years. Then he was defeated. And after a break in his political career, he became a member of Parliament from a Welsh constituency. And I also traveled with him to Wales and met many of his friends and also the sort of his agent, the man who took care of his, in a sense, political appointment calendar in Wales. And again, all of these people were kind of curious about me. They would ask these tentative questions about, you know, how I got to know Michael and so on. They were sort of, you know, feeling me out as to what's going on here. How is this person handling himself? All along, I'm watching May, December, and I'm thinking of Elizabeth doing the same thing, meeting people, people sizing her up, she sizing people up. She accompanies Gracie to a department store where she is picking out clothes for her daughter. There's a wonderful mirror scene where they're looking at each other in a mirror, and Elizabeth is beginning to perfect some of the gestures, some of Gracie's gestures that will no doubt be used in the film. So you've got, you've got the actress, but I'm thinking you've got the biographer who's tagging along, who's becoming part of the story as a way of getting the story, so to speak. And the other thing I want to say about Elizabeth is she's not compromised. In fact, one of the reviews I'm looking at right now is about, well, the reviewer says, Elizabeth's quest to become, she puts in quotation marks, to become Gracie is ultimately predatory. Now, that's how some people began to regard me with Michael, especially when the book got into galleys. And they saw that I was writing about Michael's affairs. He had some affairs outside his marriage. That there were criticisms of his character that made it in the book. I got calls from women who were friends of his, and some of them, again, were secretaries, saying, "How dare you?" You know, they didn't use these words, but essentially they were saying, "You're dealing with a labor icon. You can't say these things about him." They weren't disputing the truthfulness of what I was saying, but rather, oh, this is going to be used by the Daily Mail and, you know, the tabloids and so on. And it was, some of it was, frankly. And all I can say is I was trying to get at what the marriage was really like and what the man was really like. One of the other words that a reviewer uses is, well, they say about Elizabeth, the actress who's going to play Gracie, the more she is drawn into the story, the more callous Elizabeth becomes. She is, because she's there. She's there on a kind of mission, as friendly, as understanding, as empathetic as she is. The way Natalie Portman plays her, she's drawing a line, at least in her own mind. She's sizing up these people just as they sized up her, and it's going to go into her performance. At the end of May, December, I'm not really spoiling anything for you if you haven't seen it. There's a scene where she's playing her character. You know, they're filming the film, in other words, about the story that she's been investigating. So I think, in terms of my own experience, the film was very true to the way I behave as a biographer. Empathetic? Yes. Determined? Yes. Callous? In a certain sense, yes. There was an incredible bond with Michael. And at the same time, I never kidded myself that if I said certain things in the book, they wouldn't make him angry, and they did. You know, he started out by saying, "It's your book." At the end, and I said, "I'll show you everything," which I did. I showed him everything. And at one point, I met with him, and he banged his fist on the table and said, "This has to come out." What had to come out? I had said at one point, quoting Julie, that Julie was afraid of Michael's anger. Well, here was an exhibition of that anger. And I wasn't frightened, but I could see how someone could be frightened. In fact, Julie was there. And she didn't have much to say. I didn't blame her. What was there to say? He was having a tirade, a tantrum. And I kept it in the book. I took out a few things that didn't make a difference, and then I put them back in A Private Life of Michael Foote anyway to give you the full story, the full record. The point is, he did get angry. In spite of what he said about, it's your book, I had offended his amour propre. After Joe Craigie died, he just, he didn't just grieve, he was full of remorse, as Thomas Carlyle was when his wife died. In Carlyle's case, he realized what a bastard he had been in a lot of ways to his wife. Michael could never confront that. He was such a genial person, such a happy person, that there were a lot of people who couldn't believe that he had, in a sense, a mean side or a callous side, to use that word again. And yet that's what Julie had told me, not only that Jill was afraid of his anger, but I'd interviewed other people, like Ursula Owen, who was a friend of Jill's and Michael's. And she described a scene in which he threw a fit that was just frightening, she said. So I knew that what Julie was telling me was not just Julie. It shouldn't be discounted because it was coming from her, because it came from other people. This was true in politics, but it was also true in his private life, that he had this incredible temper, this rage. It really was a rage that I only saw on that one occasion, but it was certainly enough. By the way, my reaction was not to argue with him, but to just listen and tell him that I'm listening. Later, when his biography of Joe Craigie was serialized in the Daily Mail, which he hated, he called the Daily Mail the Forger's Gazette. He called me up. I hadn't heard from him in months because I knew he was unhappy about the book. He pleaded with me, really, to get them to kill the serialization of my own book, of the biography. And they weren't sensationalizing it. They were, you know, printing what I had written. And I said, Michael, I can't do that for a couple reasons. One, I can't do it because I stand by my book. But also, I can't do it because I don't have the power to do it. One of the things in the contract, one of the stipulations in the contract, was that the publisher had the right to do that, not just to the Daily Mail, but to serialize the book. And I had absolutely no power as to where or when it would be serialized. The aftermath of the book was tremendous. I won't go into all that, except that Michael's nephew wrote me. He was one of those people who I had interviewed, and who he was one of the few people who was direct in this sense. He asked me, what are your politics? And I said, well, they're not socialist. I said, I tend to vote Democratic, but they're not socialist. Most people didn't ask that. Paul Foote was a political person, and he was all about protecting. He had his disagreements with Michael, too, but it was all about publicly protecting that Labour Party icon. And he wrote me this letter, which I did not answer because I didn't feel defensive at all, and I wasn't going to change anything because he said it. But one of his phrases I'll never forget. He said that my book was an abuse of Michael's hospitality. An abuse of his hospitality. I went into this book saying to Michael, you know, it's got to be my book. And he agreed. He said, yes, it's your book. And we even had long discussions there in A Private Life of Michael Foote about authorized biography and why it doesn't work, and why the biographer has to be independent. He understood that. And yet, In one of those conversations, I pointed out to him that he had taken out some stories about Nye Bevan, you know, the founder of the National Health Service in Britain. There was a story about an affair that Nye Bevan had had, and this was before he was married. And he took the story out, not because it wasn't true, not because the woman he interviewed had cold feet and didn't want the story in the book. She was proud of her relationship with Nye Bevan, but because Nye Bevan's wife wanted it out. And so Michael took it out. And I told him, as gently as I could, that I, you know, if that had been me, I wouldn't have taken the story out of the book. So there was that divide between us that could never be bridged. There was no way that we could reconcile our differences. Many of the things about the book didn't bother him at all. The fact that he had had affairs didn't bother him. It bothered Paul Foote and other people around him, but not Michael. Why not? Because Michael almost was proud of his ability to attract certain women. And he kept talking about William Hazlitt, who was one of his heroes, who wrote this book about his own affair called Libra Morris. And I write about Libra Morris in my biography of Joe Craigie because it was one of the, in a sense, the literary influences that affected Michael personally, as did his work on Byron as well. We had long discussions of that. When I first met Julie, his stepdaughter, Michael's stepdaughter, she said to me, when I first met her in a pub, the first night of my stay at Michael's house, in March 2000, Julie said, she came right out with it, you know, he had some affairs, but he won't talk about it. Or she said, if you do talk about it, he'll write you off. He won't cooperate. He won't give you access. And I said to Julie, if that happens, then there won't be a biography because I can't work on any other basis. And I would say after, I'd have to look it up. It's in A Private Life of Michael Foote. After the third or fourth trip, I did confront him with it. I did it very, in a sense, sneakily, slyly. I said I had found a diary in Jill's desk, which I did. And it was about secretaries and how they would abase themselves for the men they work for. And I said to Michael, I don't think that Jill is speaking hypothetically. I think she's speaking much closer to home. By the way, I recorded all this. He let me record it all. It's in A Private Life of Michael Foote. And there's like a, I don't know, couple minute gap on the recording in which he's sort of hemming and hawing until he finally does begin to tell me. Right then, and then also in subsequent days, he begins to relate to me what happened. Because he knew I was serious. I was ready to, if it came to it, I was ready to walk away. So that's what you have to consider. If you ever find yourself in such a situation, most biographers won't do that. They shy away from living figures for precisely this reason. Because there is that possibility. Well, there are lots of possibilities. One of which is that you will become part of the story. All I can say about that is what I did. You become part of the story? Sure, but on your terms. Thanks for listening.